This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. On May 9th, 32-year-old Akmal Nasiruddin Muhammad Nasir trounced then-Felda chairman Tan Sri Sharis Samad with a majority of about 20,000 votes. Now, this is no small feat. He, Tan Sri Sharis, that is, had been JB MP for six non-consecutive terms, and Johor had always been a BN stronghold, that is, until GE14, when that stronghold fell and Pakatan Harapan secured a two-thirds majority. So today on The Breakfast Grill, we welcome YB Akmal Nasir Al-Nasir, the Pakatan Harapan Member of Parliament for Johor Bahru. Welcome, Nasir, to Akmal. Welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Yeah, morning.
So congratulations on your win. I'd like to begin with a look back at GE14. Now, Akmal, before the elections, we had pundits everywhere weighing in on the fact that Johor was one of the states to watch. Now, there was something happening in Johor, happening on the ground, something that, you know, the so-called Malay tsunami. What has your post-mortem been of what happened in Johor on May 9th?
During the election term, or even before that, leading towards the elections, I think the mood among the Johorians, they want to see some change. They know Johorians are, I would say, they are proud people. So in that case, when it seems like we cannot do much towards the nation, towards the former government, the federal government, so the sentiment against the federal was quite strong. So in that case, we had to utilize the mood that we had with the people by showing that we care, we listen, and we are willing to fight for them. So in that case, I always say during the election campaign trail, if we manage to capture Johor Bahru, if we manage to capture the state, we are going to capture the Putrajaya.
So that Johor Bahru was the barometer for you.
Yes, because if Johor Bahru can fail, I think even the Johor state can fail.
So what, I guess, in hindsight, do you think led to this very decisive victory? I mean, by most measures, you would call it a decisive victory. What was it? Do you think that it was PKR and your popularity that triumphed, or was it that Tan Sri Sharir was just too close to the Felda controversies and he had been somewhat tainted by that?
I think people feel the pinch of economic situation. The cost of living was super high. And then the only thing before, they couldn't speak up. They feel like they just have to absorb whatever they feel about the situation. But I think for the first time when they see, we were really fighting for the cause. And they can see the movement, not just by any parties, but somehow we can get together. But at the same time, the credit should be given to those activists, those who campaigns throughout the years. It's not just 1 month campaigning.
But you were campaigning, or you were working on the ground in Johor for a while, right? Since 2013, if I'm
yes,
not mistaken?
Yes, it's about 5 years.
5 years. So it's not like you were parachuted in.
Yeah. But although, in that sense, I did know the ground. I did know the grassroots people. But at the same time, when you are talking about the voters, it's 100,000 voters there. So I don't think people know me 100%. I know. I mean, the awareness about the new guy, is about the new kid on the block is very limited. But at the same time, I think they feel it's a good time to give a chance. Mm-hmm. If they could give a chance before to Tan Sri when he was contested, at I think about my age back then, so they feel like maybe this is about the time.
He did start very young as a political secretary, didn't he? So talk to me about the issues in Johor Bahru when you were campaigning. Are there issues that are unique to JB? You know, things like the Iskandar development. Did that become a political bane for the previous state and federal government?
I think we know the problem with the development because it doesn't really concentrate on the common people. But it's not enough just to bang on it. I think what we need to do, or what we had to do back then, was to point out actually the problems are, or the problems were, we didn't have enough affordable houses. So rather than just keep blaming the projects or the plan by the previous government, we should actually point out what it should be done. So in that case, people can relate. They understand they had to pay GST, for example. They didn't mind to pay if, for example, the money is being used wisely. But then when you pointed out there are so many corruption, there are so many mismanagements, then they can relate what happened when the government is not focusing on them. They are being left out from all this development.
So you were also, I think previously before you were heavily campaigning for this seat, you were also the resource, chief resource officer for Invoke Malaysia, the pollster. In the lead up to GE14, Invoke had very boldly, I might add, predicted that Pakatan Harapan would form the next federal government with a simple majority. In fact, I might add, Invoke was the only pollster that had consistently on record predicted a Pakatan Harapan win even as early as January of 2017. Mm. Now, why do you think that those predictions were not taken as seriously until the very last days of before GE14? Do you think that many quarters had dismissed these predictions because or as Rafizi's bias towards Pakatan Harapan?
Personally, when I got the numbers from Rafizi, I mean, when he shared with the team,
Rafizi founded Invoke Malaysia.
When he shared the finding of the poll, I personally didn't believe it. The number was too good to be true. But then, when we keep double-checking, I mean, when the team keep analysing the numbers, keep calling for second, third time to confirm, and then we track the movement on monthly basis, then it seems like the numbers is real. I mean,
what were the numbers based on?
It's based on the telephone survey that we conducted, and we did test out using the automated voice as well as the human interaction, because we know there are biases, etc. But then those in survey, the biases you can actually weigh out when you put the statistical way to put out all these differences. Mm-hmm. But what's more important is that I think the success of the team of Invoke, they managed to sample out to get the right population for each of the constituency. So in that case, they are not making up the numbers. They were actually going through the details and they make sure the sample represent the population of the voters rather than just get the public opinions, because public opinions matters for certain things. But in the election, voters' opinions matters.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering how you guys got the predictions on the Pakatan Harapan capturing the federal government so right, and yet you got your predictions on PAS so wrong. I mean, you had predicted, or Invoke had predicted, a green tsunami, that PAS would not win a single seat. Now, this hasn't turned out to be accurate. So how did you get your predictions on PAS wrong?
Because I think this, in terms of the parameters, on my view, I mean, the team may have different opinion, but I would say we focus more on the Pakatan Harapan and Barisan Nasional's permutation, because what we need to make sure is that we will get enough majority to win. So in that case, in Terengganu or Kelantan, for example, it doesn't matter who come second or who come first, is just between Pakatan and Barisan. So what I mean is, like, other parties they may get, but we don't really bother that much, because our focus back then was to make sure Pakatan can win. Who should be the next popular party? Or in Kelantan and Terengganu, for example, when they don't want to choose Pakatan, we know that, but if they choose PAS, it doesn't matter to the plan for Pakatan Harapan to capture Putrajaya.
I'm speaking to YB Akmal Nasir, first-term Johor Bahru MP. Now, he's also vying for the post of Youth Chief of PKR in the upcoming party elections. So we're going to be talking about that next on The Breakfast Grill. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. Thanks for staying with The Breakfast Grill. I'm Melissa Idris. Now, we'll continue our conversation with the Pakatan Harapan MP for Johor Bahru, Akmal Nasir. Let's talk about your first term Member of Parliament now, that you're going to Parliament now, as Parliament sits. What are the issues that you will be championing?
There are several issues that actually on my plate. For example, of course, we need to really empower the youth. I think what the previous government focused on, they only focused on certain segments of the youth, while the majority of the youth are being left out. What I'm saying is, for example, the common issues like housing, jobs, entrepreneurship, it does involve a big chunk of the youth. But these people have to fight with other group or other segment of the society. Mm. The second part, I think, what's quite urgent now is in terms of the good governance. We know we won partly because people felt dissatisfied with how the previous government conducted themselves. So this is a real challenge because it's easy to say rather than just to actually practice it. So in that case, when we are the part of the government, we have to ensure, we have to actually fight within the system to make sure all these promises, all this accountability, integrity and good governance can be taken place.
Okay. Well, you know, Akmal, you've been involved with whistleblowing for quite a while now. You and Rafizi co-founded the National Oversight and Whistleblower Centre in 2012 now. And you were part of the team that uncovered the National Feedlot Corporation scandal. You helped uncover the financial mismanagement at YAPIM, the Malaysian Islamic Economic Development Foundation. Are you going to be bringing these up? I mean, I know you have brought up the National Feedlot Corporation in Parliament. Are you going to combine your work with whistleblowing as, you know, in using your platform as MP in Parliament?
As of until today, I keep receiving all the complaints and...
Still? Are you still active in now?
Yeah. I mean, I have to balance out between
political duties come first.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, people do refer to us in terms of some questions regarding NGOs or regarding some GLCs in the government. So what I'm trying to do now, rather than just exposing to the public directly, we should bring up to the ministers. We should bring up to the parliaments.
Does it change your role as part of this whistleblowing NGO? Does that change now that you are part of federal government?
I think the NGO can coexist. It's not to say you have to be vocal against the government. But at the same time, when we set up the NGO, the main focus is the advocacy. When we started to expose all these scandals, it was not the interest of just to expose them. It was actually to raise up the public understanding that this is wrong. This is mismanagement. You have to fight against it, even though you may face some consequences. Mm. So in that case, I think advocacy can be continued. And I think it's even better because you can actually cooperate with the government agencies. You can actually bring up the matters more effectively because in terms of these victims, in terms of the people within that organization that face the trouble, they want to see some solution. They are actually not happy just to be exposed, the problems.
They want accountability.
They want the accountability.
Some closure. So what other skeletons have you uncovered? He's smiling into the mic.
Yep. Well, I'm trying to bring up one case involving one government agency. Although I will try to go through the parliamentary process, there is a special chambers that you can raise up for the specific topic. So in that case, I just want to know more, just to ask nicely, if there is no action being taken, then we will figure out different ways.
Okay, ask nicely first and then yes. Take action later. Okay, Akmal, it's coming up to 100 days of Pakatan Harapan now in government. Of the 10 promises that Pakatan Harapan had promised for the first 100 days, I think it's only made headway in about 5 or 6. Abolish GST, stabilise the cost of petrol, the PTPTN blacklisting policy, I can go on. But what is your gauge or how would you mark the Pakatan Harapan report card for 100 days in an objective and honest manner?
As a backbencher, I mean, we are supposed to support the government. whenever we want to pass the bill, definitely we will be there. But at the same time, we know there will be some restraint, some maneuvering need to be done by the executive. So we have to balance out. Our role as the backbencher as well is to become the check and balance. So in that case, I think I got into the heat when minister debated or give the answer about National Security Council. He was actually trying to explain they are doing the study, etc. But I keep put my record straight.
Mm.
You shouldn't done the study just to consider either we should continue or abolish NSC. You should conduct the study how we can abolish NSC. So that's the difference. So in that case, so long the government is trying their best to fulfill the promise, that is actually people will actually appreciate it.
Do you think so? Do you not think that, you know, with a more watchful populace, a more vocal populace, that they are giving this opportunity of 100 days for Pakatan Harapan to fulfill the promises it made? But after that, you know, we want some answers. Why haven't you achieved? I mean, why were there U-turns on some of the promises made under the manifesto, like the UEC?
That's why I think it has to be transparent. Even though the my feeling is like when I got the answer from the minister, why you didn't actually consult us about it? So in that case, you can see when a lot of other leaders are starting to tell the public, it's okay to comment, it's okay to bring up the matters, because we need to make sure the transparency will take place.
How would you ensure that? You know, I'm looking at a Malaysian Insight poll on the 100 days for Pakatan Harapan. The question was, are you happy with Pakatan Harapan's first 100 days in office? 74% said no, Akmal. What is Pakatan Harapan doing to manage the expectations that are falling short of people's expectations, people who voted for them to come into federal government?
That's what I mean. If there are two things on that matter, if you are talking about the polling, it has to be fairer. I mean,
From Invoke, is
yeah,
this?
Yeah, so in that case, it's okay. It's normal. The net citizen will give feedback, which we will listen to. But in terms of the expectation, even in my case, people expect a lot higher. But at the same time, the reality will start to kick in. It's not, we are not talking about 100 days. We are talking about the movement to change the government for 60 years. So although I would say we need some time, or we actually looking ahead, not just to sprint, but it's a marathon. It should be look into the 5-10 years plan. But at the same time, I agree. I mean, people should actually put the pressure on the government even on daily basis. Don't let them sit, feel comfortable in the executive. They have the powers. They should deliver the promises.
Well, questions will definitely remain over Pakatan's ability to see through all of their promises. But, you know, internal political strife has been the biggest concern for voters. Now, we saw a very public display of dissatisfaction over cabinet choices recently. How would you describe the cooperation between the coalition parties?
I think the coalition remained intact. Although now...
How intact? How strong is that relationship?
I am not privy in terms of the Presidential Council. That is the highest body in Pakatan. But what I can see, like the way we conduct in Parliament, I mean, there is no barrier between different MPs from different parties.
Is there friction between Anwar and Mahathir?
I think we have to give way for Mahathir to lead the nation. While we know the plan for Anwar to become the next Prime Minister. So in that case, I don't think any problem should arise. Anwar knows his role. But if you ask Anwar just to sit on the sideline, he can't. I mean, if you ask me, I have to be patient in terms of not saying anything. You cannot. This is the country that respect the opinion. We want to have a new Malaysia. While people can give opinions, people can actually do some of their work. If Anwar wants to go around the country, he can. What was so wrong for him to meet the voters? So in that case, I don't think the fraction is there. I mean, people will try to always speculate.
Well, there's speculation, Akmal, because, you know, before GE14, the cooperation between these two men and the parties that they brought along with them was really to bring down the Barisan National Government. Now that that's done, what's holding this coalition together?
The idea of to make sure the reform will take place. For us, we are part of the coalition, PKR, and we need to give full support to the current government to make sure the reform can be take place. So in that case, if there is any hiccup, if there is any differences, we can address openly. So we shouldn't feel like, because now you are the government, everything should be quiet. You shouldn't question your leadership. While at the same time, Pakatan, the success of Pakatan is because we don't sanction anyone to say what they feel right to say.
Well, let's trickle that down to Datuk Sri Azmin and Rafizi Ramli, because the rivalry between Azmin and Rafizi is an open secret. It was intensified after the Kajang move, and now it's dominated PKR internal politics. Help us understand why there's tension between these two men.
I think it's normal in any party or in any political democratic process. In the case of rivalry between Azmin or Rafizi, as what people always want to put there, I think is the differences, maybe the way they conduct or they run their political activities or political work. For Rafizi, I think he is always be seen as an activist, always be seen as someone who cannot shout his mouth whenever he feels the need to speak up. And somehow, because of that, people do like him and people do hate him. So he cannot avoid it. So in that case, the differences will always be there. But I don't think it's to tell that they cannot coexist. I don't think that's the way it is. I mean, they can actually work together. Although people think the rivalry may be bad to the party, I think it's a very positive communication between the two.
Do you think it's positive? I mean, the battles between those aligned with Rafizi and those aligned with Azmin is likely to permeate the party elections soon. Do you think this kind of factionalism is healthy for
so long PKR? The fighting is on the how to show how more effective we are. If we focus on the positive side, it shows that competition can be healthy. Although, as what people caution, you shouldn't hit people below the belt. You shouldn't be personal.
Can I ask, what's the difference between the two camps? Is there a difference in ideology?
The difference of approaches. Rafizi is more activist, more people-centric. I think Azmin is more on the so-called leadership style, the way what politician used to be.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so I'd like to thank our guests today on The Breakfast Grill. I've been speaking to YB Akmal Nasser, Pakatan Harapan member of parliament for Johor Bahru and vying for the post of PKR Youth Chief in the upcoming party elections. Thank you so much for being on The Grill today.
Thank you.
I'm Melissa Idris for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.